This is Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe.
All right, welcome everyone. Another edition of Holding Court. I got my good buddy Peter Bodo here, the legendary writer of all things tennis. In addition, of course, helping me write my two books. Pete texted me over the weekend, wants to talk about some tennis issues. So as we've done before, the floor is yours, Pete. You can ask away, but I thought, why not put it on the pod? People love hearing from you and having you on, and I hope you're doing well. What's the fishing situation right now? Because, you know, Pete is an avid fisherman, but maybe not the right time of year. What's the deal with your fishing exploits?
Slowing down now a little bit on a steelhead fishing, which is my number one love, which is basically a sort of a spring-winter game and also a late fall game. So, but the trout fishing is picking up, so I'll have stuff to do when I'm not working.
Yeah, you always have things to do. So speaking of working, you texted me over the weekend about some issues that I've actually been thinking about as well. So why don't you ask away and we can get into it. We're recording this on Monday, by the way, during the Italian Open, which is happening, of course, in Rome. We'll release this on Tuesday. It'll be our Tennis Tuesday edition here on Holding Court.
Yeah, well, there's kind of a macro and a micro element here for me because, you know, one thing I wanted to delve into is the Cincinnati tournament situation.
Right.
Which is going to be, it's up in the air. Let me ask you as a reporter now, and you as a subject, what have you been hearing about this move? Are people happy with this? Do they think this is a good idea for the USTA to let this tournament as treasure to Cincinnati go?
Well, USTA no longer involved in running it. Of course, Todd Martin, who I just replaced, two of us replaced him, myself and Dan Faber taking over at the Tennis Hall of Fame. Dan, of course, the CEO, which Todd had that role, and I took over as the president. So we were laughing because sort of like took two of us to fill Todd's shoes at the Hall of Fame. So I've just started with that. Todd left to go in and run the tournament in Cincinnati, also the tournament in Charleston as well. So honestly, Pete, I just heard about this sort of on social media in the last week or so. I've been going to Cincinnati for I don't know how long, since the mid-late 80s when I was playing, and obviously covering it for so many years for ESPN. I mean, one of the best tournaments of the summer, incredibly well attended by people from all over the country, but particularly from the Midwest. So, you know, rumblings out there that this may be moving to, I believe it was Charlotte, right, North Carolina. That's also another great tennis area, North Carolina. I've been part of some great Davis Cup matches there in Winston-Salem and Charlotte, in fact, over the years. So, Charlotte seems to me like a great place for tennis. But, of course, the tournament in Cincinnati has been incredibly successful over the years. So, the gentleman who owns these two tournaments now, the one in South Carolina and the one now the Cincinnati tournament, the Western and Southern, as it's called at the moment. I guess it wouldn't shock me, but really what I have no inside information is my point. I've just seen the reports come out on social media and in some press. What have you heard?
Well, you know, the interesting thing to me really in a way is that, okay, I think Cincinnati has been one of the great stops on the ATP Tour Masters 1000. It's the oldest tournament we've had in the U.S., you know, it's the oldest ongoing tournament that's held in the same place. I remember when it was actually, I believe at one point it was the U.S. clay courts is what it was. Now, then it switched to hard and yada, yada, yada. I'm kind of wondering, is it, you know, do they want to give it up that easily? It was a very popular tournament. People love it. A successful tournament. It's not like, you know, it was a bomb of a tournament and nobody wanted to go. It had great community support. The man who really was the prime mover there once it got rolling was a man named Paul Flory, who was just a wonderful guy. He's your
incredible, incredible guy, yeah, incredible person.
Midwestern, modest as a day is long, friendly, bought off the rack suits, it seems. You know, the whole, he was just like the real deal of a certain kind of American. It was great. And after he died a couple of years ago, you know, some years ago now, his son took over and ran it for a while. And, you know, so I don't know if it's just running out of energy or out of steam or what happened, but it was just, so the question is, you know, do we want to trade that off? Granted, in Charlotte, they're planning on building a big stadium that will also be used for music and various other things. So, you know, is it worth the trade-off? I mean, do we want to give up that big a chunk of tennis history?
You know, I think, listen, as you mentioned the volunteers, right? I mean, there's the people working that tournament, like you said, volunteers that have been there for 40, 50 years. I mean, you talk about salt of the earth people that absolutely love the sport, love the community. So it really, it's amazing because when you look at the Masters events, for the most part, Pete, and you know this better than anyone, you got major cities in Europe, you know, Madrid, Paris, Paris are French, Rome, Monte Carlo is a Masters 1000. Then you've got, you know, Canada, the two biggest cities in Canada. And so it's always sort of like a little weird, and I think it was because of the history of the tournament, that Cincinnati, and by the way, it's not even in Cincinnati, it's about 25, 30 minutes from downtown Cincinnati in beautiful Mason, Ohio, which is more known for Kings Island Amusement Park. So it was always sort of weird that it had this big of a tournament. So yes, it's been incredibly successful, but nothing lasts forever, Pete. I mean, and again, I don't say this in any way to denigrate the event. I mean, they built new stadiums. They sort of kept up. But it was always a little weird for the European guys, you know, who I was very friendly with. You know, they'd come, you know, stay in these, you know, go to these major cities, and then they'd come and stay at, I'm not even going to say the names of some of the hotels because I don't want to get in trouble, but, you know, some smaller hotel chain types. And it's sort of grown over the years, but it was always sort of, misplaced is the wrong word, because as you said, it was very successful, but it doesn't surprise me to see someone, you know, come in and take it over and want to bring it to a different part of the country. That doesn't surprise me. There's a lot of people over the years that I've heard say, how come we're not, you know, we don't have a big tournament in Chicago? Of course, remember, I played my brother in the finals of the tournament, the only time I played him in a final. But Chicago's never been like a big tennis viewing town. It's never been that successful there. So, as I said, North Carolina has a lot of tennis tradition. Charlotte is a booming town, you know, oh, city, I should say, overall. So I guess I'm not that surprised. I kind of get it, as much as I love the event in Cincinnati. But I think a lot of things still, to me, have to happen before it actually happens.
No, I hear you. And you're right. It's an interesting point about the smaller cities. You have tournaments like, there were other successful tournaments that fell by the wayside because it could no longer keep up with what the ATP and other people were demanding of tournaments. Stratton Mountain was a very good example. Oh, I remember I took you and Jim Grabber pups playing doubles. I took you guys out to dinner and picked up the check. And if you see a reporter
picked up a check. Wow.
I did. And when you see a reporter pick up a check, you know it's special, right?
But you're right. That's one of those tournaments. You know, it moved to Yale, to New Haven, because the ATP said you have to have a permanent stadium, and they weren't going to build that in Stratton, which was one of the best tournaments in the summer leading up to the U.S. Open. So it moved to New Haven. It was reasonably successful there for a short period of time, but not really. And then it became a women's event, a women's only event. So that sort of petered out. They built this massive tennis facility on the campus of Yale University, which is now basically just sitting there. So I guess to your point, you're kind of onto something. You got to be careful. You know, you got to be careful with what you do, because the ATP puts these rules in place. I mean, look what happens to the Miami Open. I mean, that was because they didn't want to build permanent stadiums other than the main stadium in Key Biscayne, went to the Hard Rock Cafe, the Hard Rock Stadium. You know, that's gotten mixed reviews over the years. My buddy James Blake, you know, I understand he's doing his best he can, but just because of the bigness of the main facility makes it a little difficult, you know, to sell it, even though the outer courts and the other, you know, Key Biscayne had an amazing feel to it. I still miss going there for that tournament.
No, I agree with you 100% on that one. It's a very surreal situation down there at the Hard Rock Stadium. One other thing, by the way, about the Stratton thing, you know, one of the reasons, and another huge reason they had to leave was because the ATP, they would have had to have night sessions to be able to meet the nut for the ATP, and they couldn't do it in a resort place because the people wouldn't stand for it. I mean, I think what's also the other thing that is sort of dovetails here with these issues is that there seems to be a lot of consolidation going on now. It almost looks to me like they're trying to push the small tournaments aside, no more, you know, get rid of the 250s maybe, cut down or maybe add one or two 500s that, you know, up the ante in terms of the prize money and everything. And, you know, and of course what we have is now these 2-week tournaments. Madrid's a 2-week tournament. They're basically Grand Slam tournaments other than the first round bye. So what's your take on it? Is that a good thing for tennis? Is this where we need to go?
Well, I think overall, I call them the 10-day. Now they're, you know, then they became 12-day, and now they're basically, as you said, 2-week tournaments. I think it's tricky because, first of all, I mean, I find that they just take too long. I mean, it's not, you know what I'm saying? Like, they play every other day. I mean, the beauty of this old, the Cincinnati's of the world and the way Rome used to be, which these guys went toe-to-toe day after day after day. In some ways, it was almost harder to win some of those events, particularly the back-to-back events. You know, Cincinnati, Canada, you know, Rome, Madrid, you know, they used to be right next to each other. You'd have to win, like 10 to 11, 12 matches against all top players, basically, because you don't get the one or two sort of easier matches you get in majors because the cutoff's a lot lower to get into the majors. So I think it's precarious. That being said, let's be honest. The 2-week events are the most, by far the most successful events. If they continue to raise prize money so that the players get paid, right, for you know, because basically they're giving up another tournament. Now, does that hurt the guys at the top of the game? Not so much. But it hurts the guys like me that were, you know, 30 to 100 in the world because those players, you know, they're not getting to the quarter semis of those events. Yeah, they can get bigger prize money checks in the first couple of rounds like they get at the majors. But I'm seeing you're starting to see more in the second week of these tournaments, like the tournament Murray won in Aix-en-Provence, you know, the second week of Madrid. He won it, and he played Malfis in the first round. You know, that was during week two of a 2-week event. So they've got to make more job opportunities available. But the bottom line, Pete, is in a lot of parts of the world, particularly in the U.S., you know, the 250s and the 500s have really struggled to make ends meet. Those tournaments struggle to make it, to make some money. You know, of course, the players, they're players, so they want their prize money to keep going up. But it's become more challenging. And even in Europe, where, you know, tournaments like Marseille and, you know, smaller events around Europe are normally pretty popular, my sense is that they're starting to have a little more trouble as well as the bigger events get bigger, right? The majors just keep getting bigger. They're more successful than ever. And so now you've got these Masters 1000s joining, you know, with the women more and more, so that all of these become like mini majors, because that has worked. You know, certainly worked in Indian Wells. It's worked in Miami to a certain extent, and now they're trying it, you know, more so in Europe. Not to mention the fact, Pete, that because they can have the men and women playing together over the course of 2 weeks, it cuts down on their overall overhead. Right, rather than having a men's and a women's events at two different times, which is sort of how Cincinnati started. They would do the women's event first, and then it would go into the men's event for a week. And now having them all just together, it cuts their costs a little bit while still, you know, being able to raise sponsorship and raise prize money so the players themselves can make more money, because they're giving up 2 weeks instead of 1 week.
Well, it's interesting you say too about those smaller events that are being tucked in. It may actually improve conditions for some 250s, because if you can get the guys like the Murray first week losers at the you know, upset victims at the big Masters events and stuff, if they go for the second week, there's a lot of guys going to be around. You had Tommy Paul playing Murray there, I think, as well.
Right.
As
Mark Mason. Yeah, the final. That's right. Yeah.
Exactly. So now you can really have, you know, maybe these tournaments get a little more resonance because they can actually maybe sell against, well, gee, guess what? Andy Murray's coming to our tournament. And, you know, Francis Tiafoe, who won 2 weeks ago and he lost in Rome, but here he is. He's coming to our little tournament because he needs another clay event before Paris. So that might...
Here's the one problem with that. And I think generally you're right. The one problem is these tournaments... You know, the reason they sign players, right, you know, because these tournaments can pay guarantees at 250 and 500 level to players, they do it well in advance so that they can sell tickets, sell sponsorships. So the problem with what you're talking about, and I agree that's going to happen, is that they don't get the value of the player, you know, being able to sell it until literally the week before the tournament. So that they lose, you know, they might, you know, as a tournament director, you'll say, hey, you know, we're going to get some players that lose early in Madrid. Okay, well, who? Well, we don't know, because it's not until the tournament actually happens. So that's where, you know, when tournament, you know, I remember DC a couple of years ago, I went there, Rafa played. Remember he played, and I think he lost his first or second match. And they sold out the tournament for the entire week based on the fact that he was just in the tournament. You know, he ended up losing, but they still reaped the benefits of him being there through ticket sales and through sponsorship and so on. So that's something that's a little precarious for those tournaments that are looking to sell the players that they signed to come in and help, you know, raise money for the tournament.
Hey, one other funny thing about that would be, I just occurred to me that, so Andy Murray, if he doesn't, let's say, lose his first round, they haven't offered him appearance fees, so he wouldn't be inclined to play that 250. But all of a sudden, it's like, wait a second. Do I want to bite off my nose to spot in my face? I need clay court matches. Yeah, they're not paying me, but I need matches, so there I go. So maybe it'll be a win for some of these smaller events. The other thing I think that's kind of interesting there is the way it's really lifted the women's game so much, and how the women's game is really, I think, if we're looking at equal prize money, like if you're going to look at the figures at the end of the year and see a great measure of equality and stuff, it's going to be through these mixed events, I think, unless the WTA really catches fire as a promotable single tournament.
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, there's no doubt that the women and the men together is, I think, more benefiting the women's tour from a financial perspective. Now, certainly, if you just look at the tournaments on the individual tournaments on the WTA tour and on the ATP tour, generally speaking, I'm speaking generally, you might have a couple of exceptions. The ATP events are better, more well sponsored. The TV coverage is better. The ticket sales are better. That's generally speaking. But when you put them both together, you say a rising tide lifts all, and that should help both the men and the women in the long run. But if you are a male player, you could see being a little bit annoyed as that, you know, takes place, because they're like, wait a second, you know, we're losing, you know, the strength that we have as an individual tour. You know, it's like the men's and women's golf tours. You know, they're pretty separate. And the men's tour is a lot more successful. Now, women and men have traditionally played together, and I think that's a positive for the sport. I've always said, you know, tennis is way ahead of the curve when it comes to men and women playing on equal footing in the majors, in the schedule, in the TV. There's always little issues that come up during tournaments that one side complains about, we have to play at night, and how come we're not getting scheduled on the center court? But generally speaking, you know what it's best for? It's best for television, and it's best for the fans and the sponsors.
No, I hear you. You know what's interesting to me, like to have your take on this, is that, you know, it went from the equal prize money issue with the women and men, went from being a situation where first people were against it because the men did more work. You know, they're paying
best of five or
right. Exactly. All that. Then it went to, well, you know, who brings all the money in, right? That's, you know, right. Then it became, yeah, so men bring in more money, therefore they should earn more money, man to man. Then it became about, you know, how much time are you putting in on a court? Women, you know, women are winning 6-1, 6-3 until the quarterfinals, and they're only paying 49 minutes. And then all of a sudden it came around finally when everybody forgot those arguments and said, look, we could both benefit by having us together. And that is going to be what actually creates equal prize money, I think, was this. So it's not going to be any of the things that were originally sort of on a table.
Right. I never bought the argument of it because men play best of five or play longer or say more competitive early matches. To me, that it was always about what fans want. You know, it's like when I buy a ticket for a concert or go to a Broadway show, you know, I'm not buying the ticket based on how long it is or if there are men or women in it. I'm buying on why I want to see. So to me, it's the same thing in tennis, whether it's television rights, whether it's sponsors, whether it's fans, you know, buying tickets for the matches. What do they want to see more? Generally speaking, over the history of tennis, there's been more demand for men's tennis. That's just a fact. Now, that's starting to change, and there's certainly you could pick certain instances, Serena at the U.S. Open last year, for example, Ash Barty winning the Australian Open, no doubt. And you know what? Over time, like you said, it gets to a point where your sponsor, your ESPN or Tennis Channel buying the rights to these big events, you want both. And some days the women's matches are going to be more interesting and more competitive or more what fans want to see. Some days it's going to be men's matches. And that's just a fact. And so that's why I never bought the argument about length of match. It's really about what the people want to see. That's, to me, is what it's all about.
So what is your take? Rafa in the French or out of the French?
You know, I hope he shows up, Pete. You know, we'll wrap up with this. Alcaraz, by the way, just getting upset today in Rome, which I'm not surprised. Guy from Hungary, I never heard of. He qualified, and I watched a little bit. The guy was ripping the ball off both wings. Tremendous talent.
I saw the score. I didn't see the match though, but it was, so the guy looked pretty good.
Really good. And so anyway, I wasn't surprised because Alcaraz has won so many matches. I figured, you know, he's probably going to go out early just to rest, get himself
right.
Joker, Novak still in. We'll see how he looks in his next matchup coming up. That's Tuesday night, Rome time. I mean, I hope Rafa can show up and play. I don't think he's going to show up just to show up, though.
Uh-huh.
He's going to show up only if he thinks he can actually make a run for it. You know, Serena, for example, last year at the Open, I mean, I know she said she thought she could win it, but I don't think anybody really believed that just watching her leading up to it. I don't think Rafa is going to show up to play like a match or two in Rome. I don't see that happening. So I did just see on social media this morning, Pete, that he declined the opportunity to play in a tournament next week, you know, a smaller tournament leaning into Paris just to get some matches. So I think it's a 50-50 if he even shows up at this point.
Yeah, boy, it would be kind of a big loss. It's going to feel very weird not having him around, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's going to be bizarre, but let's hope he still shows up and he can make a run. As we speak, I've got Tiafoe Musetti. Tiafoe won the first set there, and I got, how about JJ Wolf had a big win over Hurkacz. He's playing Zverev. Yeah, he's playing Zverev now. And they also, the Americans starting to do some good stuff on the clay. Taylor Fritz was pretty good early in the clay court season, which I'll leave you with this. Well, two things. Which American man has the best shot to go, you know, nobody's going to win it, but best chance to go deep at the French? And what do you make of where Coco Gauff is now? We'll finish on that, Pete.
You know, I still like Taylor. You know, I think if Taylor, you know, Taylor gets a little bit of rest now, of course, he's been a little up and down. But, you know, I think he's got the right mentality for big tournaments now. And I think he's got more staying power mentally and emotionally than some of the other guys. So I'd have to really lean toward him. And Coco, look, she's got to fix that forehand. It's just an interesting thing. It was never enough just to be called the next Serena Williams. You know, I mean, you just have to. Not that she didn't do the work or anything, but, you know, she's led a very active, outgoing life. You know, she's involved in lots of different things. She's made some commentary on social issues. She's around. She's very articulate, very fun person. You know, I don't know. She may have to go through a period here when she says to everything else, okay, I'm setting this other stuff aside because I got to become the player I know I can be.
Yeah, exactly. You got to put the work in on the court, which I think she does. But I think to your point, it's almost like you got to refocus now. She's still a teenager. The great Peter Bodo joining me here on Holding Court. As always, great to catch up. Did I cover everything you wanted to cover, Pete?
Yes. Yeah, we did a good job. We did well. Always a pleasure, Patrick.
We did better than a good job. We did a great job. The one and only Peter Bodo with me on Holding Court. We'll see you soon, Pete.
Take care. Thank you, Patrick. Appreciate it.
Don't forget to subscribe to and share Holding Court.
Holding Court is powered by Mudhouse Media.